Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter and Anne Ball. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will bring us the next part in our series on America's presidents. But first, the militant group Boko Haram has prevented many children in parts of North Africa from attending school. But the United Nations Children's Agency says tens of thousands of children in the Lake Chad area are learning from educational radio broadcasts. The radio broadcasts provide lessons on reading, mathematics, and how to stay safe during the violence. UNICEF said the broadcasts reach about 200,000 displaced and out-of-school children in the far north area of Cameroon and southern Niger. Patrick Rose is a UNICEF spokesman. He told the Thomson Reuters Foundation that the level of boredom among children in camps for the displaced is tremendous. He added that with this radio education program, children will receive lessons in a structured way that keeps them in a rhythm, so that when they go back to school, they won't be so far behind. The project is supported by the European Union and the governments of Cameroon and Niger. About 150 lessons are being broadcast in both French and local languages, UNICEF said. UNICEF also have trained local school teachers to identify and deal with security threats to protect children from Boko Haram. UNICEF says Boko Haram has killed more than 600 teachers and forced over 1,200 schools to close in Nigeria, Niger, Cameroon, and Chad. The militants have killed more than 20,000 people since 2009 and forced about 2.7 million others to flee. Opposing forces have pushed Boko Haram out of most of the territory it held in early 2015. But the group continues to attack in northeast Nigeria as well as in Cameroon and Niger. In recent months, reports of sexual bias and harassment have shaken California's Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley is famous as a center for startup businesses and high technology companies. Many of its products are popular across the United States and around the world. But some women working there say they have been mistreated. They talk about men making unwanted sexual comments in an office environment. And a number of male business leaders have left their companies. They include Travis Kalanick, the former head of Uber. He resigned from the company after women criticized the culture of the ride-sharing service. Recently, more than 30 women took part in an indoor cycling event to try to increase understanding of one issue, how male investors treat women who create startup businesses and female employees. Tim Draper, a well-known investor, owns Draper Associates and Draper University. He organized the event in San Mateo, California.
This is an exciting time for women, and I'm all for it, and let's go. Let's start businesses. There's no glass ceiling if you start your own business.
Pearly Chen is the top aide to a woman heading a technology company.
I think men have to be very important champions for women empowerment because the reality is that most decision makers today on the top, political business leaders, are men. So they have to be part of the change.
Many women have begun telling stories about the discrimination and harassment they faced when proposing ideas to male investors. Wendy Dent is the founder of Cinemerse, a tech company. Dent once worked as a fashion model. She is now a businesswoman. She says she faced harassment when she met with a would-be advisor.
What was I going to do, go to the police?
Instead, Dent worked on her company, which makes an app for computers.
I fell deeply into a hole and didn't know what to do, and I learned to code. I decided, no, he's not going to win.
As more women talk about the problem publicly and on social media, they are having an effect on the industry. Kate Mitchell is an investor in high-tech companies.
We can use things like social media now and other many outlets we have, not just the courts, to communicate what we're all seeing within the industry. And I think that's one of the biggest changes.
U.S. officials want to scan the faces of all air travelers, including American citizens, leaving the country. The Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, says it is the only way to successfully track non-immigrant foreigners. But privacy activists say it takes surveillance of innocent citizens to a new level. Since 2004, visitors to the U.S. have been required to submit to biometric identity scans. Currently, fingerprints and photographs are collected before entry into the country. DHS now says it is ready to use face scans. The agency says the goal is to better follow people who overstay their visas and to strengthen security. The agency says nearly 700,000 people overstayed their visas in 2016. That includes people who left the country one day late or those for whom there is no departure record.
In May, DHS said in a privacy study of its traveler verification service that it has been working on a biometric system for departing travelers since 2013. The agency has carried out tests at six U.S. airports in Boston, Chicago, Houston, Atlanta, New York City, and Washington, D.C. During the tests, passengers were permitted not to take part. But the DHS report says that will not always be the case. The only way for an individual to ensure he or she is not subject to collection of biometric information when traveling internationally is to refrain from traveling, the report says. John Wagner is head of the program. He told the Associated Press that U.S. citizens leaving the country will have to submit to face scans. Wagner says the agency has no plan to keep the biometric information longer than 14 days. However, that could change in the future with privacy reviews and approvals.
Jennifer Gabris is a spokesperson for Customs and Border Protection. She says officials have not examined if laws need to be changed to permit keeping the information longer. Democratic Senator of Massachusetts, Edward Markey, says U.S. citizens should be able to choose to have their face scanned. In an email message to the AP, Markey said he will closely watch the program. He wants to ensure that Americans can choose if they want to be subject to it.
Alvaro Bedoya is the executive director of the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown University. He says the government is ignoring privacy rules. He said Congress authorized scans for foreign nationals. DHS heard that and decided to scan everyone. That's not how a democracy is supposed to work. The Center on Privacy and Technology notes that many state and local law enforcement agencies in the U.S. have used face recognition searches. Last year, half of all American adults, more than 117 million people, had their information stored in a face recognition network. Several federal agencies have had access to some of the face recognition network. The Federal Bureau of Investigation, or FBI, has already collected 30 million pictures in one database.
Dan Stein is president of the Federation for American Immigration Reform. His group supports greater immigration restrictions. He said privacy concerns or concerns about the technology should not prevent the government from moving ahead with the program. U.S. citizens have already sacrificed much of their privacy as the price of fighting terrorists, he said.
The Department of Homeland Security's program to scan faces of people leaving the country is expected to cost billions of dollars, and airports do not have a system to separate Americans from foreign visitors as they prepare to take flights out of the country. Customs and Border Protection, part of DHS, says it is not practical to have separate boarding systems for citizens and non-citizens. It also says that combining U.S. citizens' passports with face scans will ensure that no one travels on a passport that is not their own.
Face recognition technology, however, is not perfect. Different expressions on people's faces could cause mistakes. Anil Jain is a computer science professor at Michigan State University. He has said the most accurate systems fail 5 to 10% of the time. Some experts say such a high rate of failure would cause big problems for airlines. I'm Mario Ritter.
Agriculture experts have a message for farmers worldwide. Take care of your soil, and your soil will take care of you. By using the techniques of conservation agriculture, they say farmers can save their land and save money at the same time. This is becoming more important as the world's population grows. More people means more food needs to be grown to feed them. Most modern agriculture looks like long rows of green crops covering large areas of land. They have neat rows of single kinds of plants with uncovered soil in between. Trey Hill's farm in the U.S. state of Maryland does not look anything like that. Instead, there are green plants mixed in with what is left from other plants. Together, they cover the soil.
If you don't like your fields to look like a mess, it has to kind of grow on you. Yet I have a lot of other owners and peers that are like, wow, what you're doing is really exciting.
So what is Farmer Hill doing that is different? He is going against farming practices that are thousands of years old. Most farmers around the world till their fields. That means they turn over and break up the soil before every planting. In modern times, they use mechanical equipment to do the work. In addition to tilling their fields, most farmers leave the soil bare or uncovered in the off season. That is when they are not growing a crop, and many plant the same crop year after year. All three of these methods can wear out the soil, however. So some experts are backing the so-called conservation agriculture used by farmers like Hill. David Montgomery is a professor of earth and space sciences at the University of Washington in Seattle. His newest book is called Growing a Revolution. He spoke to VOA by Skype.
These principles of conservation agriculture flip all three of those ideas on their head. So it's a completely different philosophy to not till, to always have the ground covered with either a commercial crop or a cover crop, and to grow a much more diverse rotation.
Farmer Hill plants his crops into what is left of the crop before, without tilling the soil. In the off season, he covers his fields with different crops. They hold on to the soil and prevent erosion when water and wind remove soil. The cover crop is not meant to be harvested. Instead, it feeds the soil. University of Maryland soil scientist Ray Weil says these fields will do better in times of extreme dryness.
This kind of cover, whether it's standing or down here, is going to drastically increase the amount of rain that soaks into the soil.
And Hill says this kind of farming is more profitable. Less tilling means using less fuel for his farm equipment. He buys less fertilizer, which are substances added to the soil, because his cover crops feed the soil. Hill, however, is not an organic farmer. He kills his cover crops with chemicals. Experts are working to help farmers in the developing world as climate change and rising populations increasingly challenge the world's food growers. I'm Ann Ball.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Chester A. Arthur. The letter A is for Alan, his middle name. Arthur took office because of an unexpected event. He was sworn in as vice president in March 1881 under James Garfield. But only 100 days into Garfield's term, the president was shot. He suffered for months. Arthur was not close to Garfield. The two men belonged to the same party, but they had different ideas on the issues of the day. They publicly disagreed on a number of subjects. If Garfield lived, Arthur would probably not have much power in his administration. But Garfield eventually died. By this time, it was well established that if the President of the United States dies in office, the Vice President becomes the President. So, in September 1881, Arthur became the country's chief executive. He served the remaining 3.5 years of Garfield's term. Historians say that, for the most part, Arthur performed ably and well. Chester Arthur was raised in the northeastern states of Vermont and New York. He was one of 8 children in his family. Their father was a religious leader and anti-slavery activist. Arthur attended college in New York, then taught school and studied law. But he never wanted to stay in a small town and live modestly. He wanted to live in New York City, work as a lawyer and public official, become wealthy, and enjoy the lifestyle of a gentleman. And that is what he did. Arthur advanced from an entry-level job in a law office to a leadership position in the military during the Civil War. After the fighting stopped, he worked in a good-paying job as a lawyer, and then accepted a top position in the government. For 7 years, Arthur served as the collector of the Port of New York. His job involved supervising 1,300 people. They collected large amounts of money that came from taxes on imported goods. The job had a political element, too. It was under the control of a U.S. senator from New York, Roscoe Conkling. Conkling was known as a Republican Party chief who traded political support for financial and other benefits. Arthur was never found guilty of accepting money or gifts in exchange for the help of his office, but he was closely linked to Conkling's political machine. When Rutherford B. Hayes became president in 1878, he tried to fight corruption in government jobs. He targeted Conkling and Arthur. Arthur's position as the collector of the Port of New York was one of the issues in the election of 1880. President Hayes had suspended Arthur from the job. To get it back, Arthur and Conkling supported an effort to re-elect former president Ulysses S. Grant. But another candidate won the Republican Party's presidential nomination, James Garfield. Garfield and Arthur were not natural allies. Although they were both Republicans, they represented different points of view. Political leaders hoped to unite the party. So when Garfield was chosen as the presidential candidate, they added Arthur as the vice presidential nominee. The effort to unite the party worked well enough to win the election, but relations between the two men were uneasy. One of Garfield's first acts was to appoint someone for Arthur's old job in New York. The new president wanted someone who was not loyal to Conkling, so he gave the position to one of his supporters instead. In protest, Conkling resigned from the Senate. But then events took an unexpected turn. Garfield was shot by a mentally unbalanced man who believed the president owed him a government job. And Chester A. Arthur became president. When Arthur took office, he had the public image of being an experienced political operator. Most people believed he cared only about supporting the aims of a small part of the Republican Party. Instead, President Arthur took an independent position on several issues. In opposition to most of his party, Arthur supported legislation to reform the country's civil service. It aimed to clean up corruption in government and took away some of the ability of politicians to give government jobs to their supporters. To be fair, in the short term, the act helped Arthur's party. Arthur also broke with the Republican Party leadership to support a reduction in tariffs. And he strongly argued to limit spending federal money on projects that helped only a few areas or businesses. Instead, he wanted to cut taxes so more people would profit from the government's surplus. Finally, Arthur vetoed an anti-immigration act from Congress. The measure proposed banning Chinese immigrants for 20 years. Arthur argued that the Chinese had improved the American economy by helping build a railroad across the country. He also did not want to hurt potential trade with China. However, when Congress offered to ban Chinese immigrants for only 10 years, Arthur agreed. In addition, his administration banned immigrants who were considered poor, criminal, or mentally insane. Perhaps Arthur's most memorable act as president, however, was to redecorate the White House. He did not like its appearance inside. So he asked one of New York's top designers, Louis Tiffany, to make the home brighter and more stylish. In the newly remodeled rooms, Arthur held parties with fine food and drink for elite guests. He was known as the gentleman boss. Observers then and now say that Arthur served well as president. He was a solid leader after the difficult years of the Civil War and Reconstruction. But Arthur did not live much beyond his presidency. Shortly into his term, he learned he had a serious kidney disease that would likely kill him. As a result, he did not try hard to get reelected. Instead, after finishing his term, he returned to his home in New York. Arthur tried to work as a lawyer, but he soon became too sick. His wife had died of malaria before he became president, and he liked to spend his free time fishing or with friends instead of with his children. But in his last months, he could not enjoy those activities either. He died at home at the age of 57. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.